How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm your host, Jeff Sturtevant, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Before we begin, remember that your support means everything to us. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to leave a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're tuning in. Watching on YouTube, give us a thumbs up, drop a comment, and hit the subscribe button. And don't forget to ring the bell icon to stay updated on all our new releases. For even more spine-chilling content, visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can become a patron and enjoy ad-free episodes. Your support helps us keep bringing the nightmares to life. Thank you. And tonight, dear listener, we have a very special guest. A voice that many of you will recognize from episode 326, The Price of Survival, which aired back on December 18th, 2024. If you missed that one, be sure to check it out. It was a good one. Back for his second appearance is Vidith22, the man behind the horror narration YouTube channel of the same name. That's V-I-I-D-I-T-H-2-2. Vidith, welcome back. I see you're already treating the place like home. Feet up on the table. And the boss usually doesn't let us smoke in here, but we won't tell him.
Hey, Jeff. It's great to be back. Last time was an absolute blast, and I'm stoked to be part of another episode. For those who don't know me, I'm Vidith22, a horror narrator, voice actor, and sound designer on YouTube. I specialize in immersive horror experiences, complete with voice acting, sound effects, and the kind of nightmarish storytelling that lingers long after the lights go out. Whether it's grotesque body horror or reality-shattering cosmic horror, if it makes you shiver, it's right up my alley. Besides my YouTube channel, you can find me on Instagram, X, and Patreon, where I keep fans updated on what's next. And of course, I'm always working on new projects and collaborations. Outside of narration, I play piano, crush it at video games, and binge horror movies. But let's be real, horror is pretty much my whole world.
That's some cigar. That's fantastic to have you back, Vidith. I've got to say, last time you delivered some truly hair-raising performances. Tonight's lineup is no different. We've got two unsettling stories that'll have you double-checking your doors and windows before bed. Our first tale will drop us into the heart of a blizzard, where a lone traveler fights against the cold, the wind, and something else. A presence lurking just beyond the veil of snow. Our second story shifts gears, taking us beneath the ominous glow of a blood-red moon, where dark forces stir, and the line between man and monster begins to blur. So settle in, dear listener, because tonight, the snow falls heavy, and the blood runs deep. Vidith, are you ready?
Always, Jeff. Let's get lost in the storm.
Our first story tonight comes to us from author Joe Barbarullo. Trapped in the midst of a relentless blizzard, a lone traveler fights against the cold. But in a whiteout, what you can't see might just be the last thing you ever hear. So without further ado, as performed by Vidith 22, I give you The Whiteout.
On November 18th, 1996, my stepfather officially went missing. My mother tearfully told me over the phone as I sat in my cubicle. I tried to get her to calm down, reassuring her that things would be okay, whispering as quietly as possible in my office, my home away from home just like any other late-stage yuppie. She muttered through yelps about how he left, said he'd be back in a few hours, hadn't come home, and the police couldn't find anything. After a little bit of apprehension, I understood simply that she needed me, and I told her I'd be home to check in on her. With a whimper of understanding at the plan, she hung up. I told my boss I had a family emergency and fled back across the East River to get packed. I rushed in and started to gather some clothes for the drive, and mirroring me was Nevada, packing up her stuff, preparing to move out following our breakup the month prior. She was standing there in one of my flannels that had assimilated itself into her wardrobe. Because of the constantly blasting heat during the winter in the apartment, she was wearing jean shorts and no socks. Her skin was pale like mine, a byproduct of our Michigander upbringing. And her hair was silky brunette, with hints of magenta peeking through where she missed on redying. I only stared for a second before shuffling over to my closet. Nevada and I had split amicably, but trying to keep living together just made things awkward, and she felt it was time for her to get her own place. I didn't say anything to her when I entered, but she noticed how frantically I was moving.
What's going on, Nate?
I told her after a moment of recollection. Martin went missing.
Martin? Like your stepdad?
Yeah. And my mom kinda needs me right now, so I gotta head back to Arrow Creek. I'm sorry, I won't be around to help you move out. I stopped, surprised to find her hand on my shoulder and her head against my arm.
I'm coming with you.
I looked down at her with a sad smile, and we said nothing more. Just continued to pack. It was the closest I felt to her in a while. Even though things weren't bad, per se, I just missed it as all. Why she would drop everything to go back to our Michigan backwater, no clue. She liked my family enough, and they definitely liked her, but she was never particularly eager to see them. Her family had left Arrow Creek ages ago, moving somewhere in the middle of Ohio, so it's not like they were there for her to see. My insecurities wanted me to believe pity was her reasoning. But I think truthfully, she just cared enough to see it was a rough time for us both, and I appreciated her tagging along despite the lapsing distance. The next morning, we trudged through the nightly puddles about half a street away to my SUV. From Brooklyn to Arrow Creek, Michigan was about a 12-hour drive without the looming threat of traffic. Along the way, I turned the radio to a local news channel, which warned of bad weather coming.
1804 WIMI with a breaking weather bulletin. I'm Toby Bell. We've got a large blizzard coming in this week, currently striking over the Great Lakes. Record snow is being predicted from around 36 to 40 inches coming in around the East Bay and Houghton Lake areas by Wednesday the 20th. It's not particularly dangerous for you northern natives out there, but caution is advised on the roads as visibility might be impaired. Make sure you bundle up if you have to head out, with temperatures dropping close to negative 7 degrees Fahrenheit on Wednesday and staying near zero until Saturday. So you might want to stay in and get cozy while the whole thing passes. We'll be back with more Monday Grunge Day in a bit. Back to DJ Keith Hodder with Alice in Chains coming up next.
Snow wasn't unusual in northern Michigan, so I was pretty unfazed as a native northerner, and it sounded like a decent change of pace from the cold rains in the city. Nevada had seemingly no reaction either, just her general curiosity fluttering through her brown eyes as she watched the highways drift by out the window. The ride was mostly uneventful, with Nevada and I trying to stave off boredom, singing along to old CDs and playing road trip games. We stopped for a short stint at McDonald's, and afterwards the food and car heater combined to put Nevada down for a nap. I turned off the radio so as to not wake her, and in that moment I had the time by myself to think about Martin. Martin and I had a strange but mostly positive relationship. He came into my life when I was around 13, and he tried his best to be a father figure to me. At that age, though, I started to not feel so keen on listening to authority. Especially some dude I barely knew who was just suddenly moving in. Looking back, I regret my attitude towards him, because he was always patient with me, even when I acted like a jerk. He took me fishing, we went to Tigers games in the summer and Lions games in the winter. He picked me up from the police station after my friends and I spray-painted dicks on the middle school, not even angry, just soft-spoken and wondering why. He tried to give me advice and taught me to be patient with myself just as much as he was me. He and Mom took Nevada and I's prom pictures. He was sad, but supportive of us moving away. I don't think I often admitted it to him or myself, but I loved Martin. I don't think I'd be the same person without him. So while I was really coming for my mom's sake, I also needed to know what happened. It wasn't like Martin to just vanish like this. By the time we arrived in Arrow Creek, snow had begun to fall pretty hard, with the fresh moonlight illuminating the clouds in a reddish hue. I pulled up to my mother's old ranch house, surrounded by tall pines starting to be dusted and white. Wind whistled off the nearby lake, making the air feel colder than it was, as harsh, warm light poured out through the early evening. I entered without knocking, finding my step-siblings Mary Beth and Jonathan running up quickly to greet me. I was rarely around since they were born. They were kids, and I was pushing 30, so they kind of just thought of me as an uncle.
Uncle Nate!
They cried, clutching to my leg. After glancing past me, they did the same for Nevada.
Aunt Nevada!
Nevada shot me an awkward smile as she greeted them. They didn't know any better. Sitting in Martin's easy chair was my mother, completely zoned out, watching reruns of MASH. Alan Alda would crack a joke, and she wouldn't even smile. Before I had a chance to go greet her, a shadow entered from the kitchen doorway on the left. It was my father, Stephen. I stared at him, no words escaping my mouth. He turned towards me, a mug of tea in his hand, and his eyes met mine, a decade's worth of distance between us.
Hi, Nate.
Hi, Dad.
That was the extent of our conversation as tension filled the air. It was broken when he spoke to Nevada.
Hi, Nevada.
He reached out his hand.
Good to see you again.
You too, Mr. Fisher.
She glanced at me vaguely. I could feel her discomfort grow as her fingernails dug into my sleeve as she clung close.
What are you doing here, Dad?
I thought I'd check in on Sharon, given the news and all.
He could see the doubt in my eyes as to why he was really here. He stepped closer.
Look, I know you hate me, but I promise you, I'm not trying to do anything to hurt your mother. I'm just worried about her is all.
Sure, Dad. It's very like you.
I grabbed the tea and walked towards my mother, leaning down next to the chair. Nevada stuck with the kids as they played with my old action figures and cars, a better choice between them and Dad. Mom stared with glazed eyes at the TV in a mindless drone, her actual thoughts elsewhere. I tried to snap her back.
Hi, Mom.
She blinked and turned towards me, sobbing softly and leaping into a hug over the arm of the chair.
Oh, Nate, sweetie,
she said into my jacket.
I'm so glad you're home.
Of course, Mom. That Nevada's here, too. And we're going to stay a day or so and help take care of you and the kids.
Nevada waltzed over hurriedly to personally reassure her. Just the kind of person she is.
Yes, Miss Foster. Anything you need, we're here for you.
Mom smiled so brokenhearted at us, but also with a lot of comfort beaming through her glassy green eyes. She wiped away a stray tear and nodded at us, softly uttering a thanks as she tried to get lost in her show once again. Nevada and I took our bags from the car and wandered towards the guest room at the end of the hall. The house had my mom's room, the kids sharing a room, my dad on the couch in the living room, the guest room, and the basement. Mom knew we were split up, but obviously in the state she was in, it wasn't of the most importance that we be separated given the circumstances. I would have been fine sharing the bed, not as if it was the first time, but because of my lingering feelings, I had to try and come up with a solution, or so I thought. So, you take the bed, And I think we may have a cot or folding bed or something in the basement. She blinked at me.
Nate, we can just share the bed.
Are you serious?
I mean, we've done it for years. What's another night or two?
I don't know. Might be weird. I don't want either of us to be uncomfortable. She could tell I meant that I didn't want her to be uncomfortable.
Me sleeping next to you is definitely a lot less uncomfortable than sleeping in the freezing basement.
I guess you're right. As I was getting ready to sleep, I heard soft crying coming from my mother's bedroom. I inched quietly down the hall so as to not wake my dad from his sofa slumber. I pushed the door to her room open and saw her on the edge of the bed, head in her hands. I rushed over.
Hey, come on, Mom. You gotta get some sleep.
She was barely comprehensible through her tears.
What if he's dead?
You don't know that, Mom.
What if he left me? What if he found someone else?
Martin's not like that, Mom.
Don't think like that. What am I gonna do?
She choked through her breaths. I stopped for a moment to come up with something to give her solace. All right, look. Where did he say he was going?
He said he was going out for a bit of fishing and maybe hunting, but I had to stop in town first. That was the last I heard from him.
All right. I'll head out tomorrow and look for him. Her crying stopped, and she looked up at me, wiping away her sniffles.
You're going to find him.
I promise I'll try. Now, get some sleep. She thanked me before laying down. I turned out her light and said goodnight. I had to really think over what I said as I walked back towards my room. It's a promise I made in sincerity, but had no idea how to fulfill. How the fuck was I supposed to know where he was? I'm an accountant and not a detective. I mean, I wanted to find him too, but the likelihood of me being able to was minuscule at best. I caught Nevada up to speed when I re-entered the guest room, and without much protest, she agreed to go on this sleuthing adventure. She was usually up for anything, so you'd think I'd be unfazed. But to just openly agree to go on an actual missing persons investigation, I expected a bit more questioning. I think she really just wanted to help, playing along if this was a midlife crisis.
Anything for your family. You know that.
I tried my best to face the wall as we slept, and Nevada was all over the place. My favorite cover hog. She looked the same as she always did. A little messy, but pretty as always. I felt safe for at least those few hours, like all this shit from the last year wasn't going on right now. Why did we even break up? I was constantly working, tired, and barely around. She felt kind of stagnant, and wanted to do something else with her life. Arts at Pratt's affording her many opportunities that weren't paying off in the oversaturated job market in Manhattan. Rent was convenient to split, but there was still a lot of emotional tension there. That's why she wanted to leave, I think. I can lie to myself and pretend it was amicable. But God, I didn't want to lose her after all this time. She was still the only person in the world I could really trust, and to just have her close by felt better than anything, even if it was only for a little while. The next morning, we tried to head out early. I said goodbye to my mom and gave a small acknowledgement to my dad before Nevada and I buttoned up in our winter best and went out to search. He stopped me at the door, the wind and snow already having invaded the yard around us.
You got a gun, Nate?
Yeah, I always keep it in my car. Why?
It's hard to see out there. You never know if you run into something.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Less chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I nodded and walked out into the unknown. Overnight, the snow had gotten heavier and a thick fog enveloped the woods. Outside was pure white, with shadows of trees and signs only peeking through the dense cloud. With cautious skill, I maneuvered into Central Arrow Creek, and never before had I seen it so dead. Even with a population of 1,100, you'd think we would have seen somebody walking a dog or something, but there was really no one. Only the occasional state snowplow barreling through every 10 minutes or so. Almost every store in town was closed on account of the blizzard, and very few cars were parked on the street. But luckily for me, an old favorite store of mine was still buzzing on. Arrowhead Diner. I pulled up out front, and Nevada and I pushed past the icy winds and through the glass doors. As we entered, I saw Ted Nielsen still guarding his post behind the counter. He was nearly 60 years old at this point, but no gray showed through his bright ginger hair that sprouted heavily across his face and bald spot. Inside his goatee was his usual cigarette, only matched by a flannel rolled up to the sleeves that sported a long john beneath it. Over his jeans sat a greasy white apron tied around his waist, sitting tightly under his beer belly. He spotted me and cracked a smile, quickly adding his cigarettes to his collection in the nearby ashtray. He rounded the corner and gave me a big bear hug.
Nate Fisher, how good to see you, buddy.
Ah, Ted, it's been too long.
I embraced him back.
And Nevada,
he chirped in excitement. He picked her up and spun her around before setting her back down. I could tell we all needed the laugh. He went back around the corner and grabbed two mugs, instantly filling them with coffee. He hollered back to the kitchen, his wife working the stoves.
And two classics on the house.
I thanked him for the coffee and stared at the TV hanging from the corner. Over highlights of the Michigan State football game was a banner warning about the weather and a few missing person notices. It seemed peculiar to me. Maybe people were really just getting lost in the storm, Martin included. I snapped out of my investigation when Ted spoke.
So, what are you doing here, City Slicker? Feeling homesick?
He joked. No. I don't know if you've heard, but my stepfather went missing.
Oh, yeah. Read it in the newspaper and couldn't believe it. Hope Martin's okay out there. And your mom, of course. I literally just saw him the day before. Life's so strange that...
Wait, you saw Martin before he went missing?
Yeah, he stopped by for lunch. He does that every other Monday.
Did he say where he was going?
Just said he was gonna maybe fish a little and go hunting. I thought he was crazy with his weather stirring up.
Shit. Do you know where he goes?
I mean, there's only one lake in town, you know that. But, I went hunting with him a few times, and usually he likes to go to Carpenter State Park between here and West Branch.
A huge lead. Maybe I wasn't so bad at being a detective after all. Nevada looked at me with urgency.
We should go. Yeah, you're right. Ted, thanks for the breakfast offer, but we should get back out there.
I plopped a 50 on the table.
All right, Nate. Wait, what's this for?
Get you and Edna home safe, all right? Get out of this storm.
Before he could protest the money, Nevada and I had already moved towards the door.
Oh, my. Thanks, Nate. You two be careful out there, you hear?
He called through the dead diner as the doorbell signaled our exit. Lucky for me, spending a lot of time around here being a delinquent youth gave me enough knowledge to know my way around, even through the minor visibility. After a while of white noise provided by blustery snowflakes, Nevada spoke to me in a concerned manner.
Nate?
Yeah, what's up?
Do you really think we're gonna find Martin out here? In this shit?
To be honest, no. But I promised Mom I'd at least try. So, here we are.
Yeah, no, right. I just hope we don't get killed in this weather.
I nodded at her reassuringly and turned back to the road. She looked worried, her eyes darting in small circles like she didn't know what to focus on. I've seen her stressed, of course, through tests in high school to job applications in the city, but worry was a different emotion for her, and something about that set my heart sinking as well. Was I just trying to play the hero, to prove something to myself or her in some desperate act? I wondered if my intentions were selfish. I don't really think they were, but... I knew either way that there was a lot of responsibility on me now. especially if something happens to Nevada. Pretty much at the point of no return, we arrive at the lake, barely visible by its large sign. The edge of East Bay connecting to our little hamlet was marked by a shoddy gravel parking lot that still managed to crunch under its powdery dress. No other cars were around, and still no sign of Martin. We managed to get out and find the elevated boardwalk that led to the shore, because its guardrails poked out of the snowbounds. We held onto them like a connecting rope, slowly pulling ourselves towards the shoreline. When we got there, there was no separation between sand or water. Everything was covered, and the lake was thoroughly frozen over. There was no car on the shore, and any possible hint of fishing or ice fishing had its evidence destroyed by the frost. As we turned back, the community events board that sat at the entrance was covered in half a dozen missing persons posters. Not only were the people from Arrow Creek, but also the surrounding Houghton Lake and East Bay areas. The newest addition was Martin's flyer, flapping at the bottom right, still shiny from its industrial print job. Something wasn't right here. How had this many people gone missing so close together, and so recently? Their dates all came within the start of November until then. There didn't seem to be a clear answer devised between either Nevada or I. While we started our way back to the car, I couldn't tell if the fog had grown or not, and it only got more difficult to tell as I had to wipe down my glasses every couple of minutes, Nevada farther ahead, and turning back to make sure I didn't get buried. We shivered as we started the car, her brown hair glistening with water droplets and my normally jet-black hair taking a white sheen. "Looks like we gotta go to the park," she joked. "Just like the good old days." I shot back. About 20 minutes passed before we crossed the sign signifying that Carpenter State Park was about a mile on its left. I felt relief pass over me as I cruised a little faster through the mist. I felt comfortable at this higher speed until something lurched out of the woods and passed the car. I slammed on the brakes and skidded off path across the rumble strips before pulling myself to a stop on the side of the road. Nevada and I gasped in panic, confused at what had happened.
"What the fuck was that?"
"I have no fucking idea." I really didn't even know what it was. It blended in with all the white surroundings. I looked around for any sign of it, but saw nothing. Other than something round and black in the uncharted woods about 50 feet out. "Nevada, look. I think there's a tire out there."
"Martin's car?"
We got out quickly, but before I did, I made sure to grab my .38 police special revolver I kept in the glove compartment for emergencies. I'd never used it before, but this felt like the right time for a christening. Remembering what my father said, we waddled towards the car, and there it was. Martin's, no doubt. I recognized his Ford Explorer anywhere, buried in the snow, but its red paint contrasted against it. Nevada looked around the car, trying to get inside, but there was no sign of Martin. I looked further into the woods, a long stretch of trees that led to a steep, high-standing cliffside that overlooked it. A bright light peeked through a sizable crack in the cliffside, and among it stood two figures. I could barely make them out in the fog or at this distance. They looked like two men, tall and lanky, both bald and standing naked, and blisteringly pale, out in the bare elements. Their frame and skin was one thing that didn't feel out of the ordinary, but the way they stood and watched from behind the trees without any sort of clothes or uttered noises gave me pause. I felt a chill, not from the snow, and despite my fears, I felt the need to push forward. "Keep an eye on the car," I said to Nevada, who agreed. She had already started breaking into it for a sign of life, or something that would signify what had happened. As I approached the lit crack, the two figures gave ungodly clicking screeches before retreating into the fog and over the cliff. Okay, so definitely not normal. I heard my heavy breathing and my puffy jacket sliding along itself. And something else. Something new. A pulsing, wet sound coming from the crack filled with light. It wasn't just a crack, but a hole. I tried to look in with not much payoff, and finally decided after feeling around with my arm that I could squeeze myself through. When I entered this crack, I expected a small overhang of rocks, and eroding part of the cliffside that just led out into the other side of the forest, the most reasonable place for the white light to be coming from. But instead, I found what I could only reasonably describe as a hive. The whole of the cave was filled with a stretchy white material, like spider webs made from polymer, as if the whole thing was carved from erasers. Lining walls were these pods, rows and rows of translucent eggs with people. The people who had gone missing. Their bodies slowly digesting in one pod, and replicas forming in adjacent ones. Some H.R. Giger-esque nightmare. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. A sick joke, an elaborate prank. That was the least reasonable justification. One part was empty, however, and sitting at the base of its cracked shell was Morten, in his hunting gear, looking frozen and wet.
Holy shit, Morten, are you okay?
I'm fine, he said, no infliction or exasperation in his voice. At that moment, however, I didn't notice.
Come on, let's get you out of here.
I grabbed his arm and yanked towards the hole. He pulled away.
Why? Why? Because we're in a fucked up nest, Morten.
It's so nice down here.
I stood up quickly and stepped backwards, the white uterus around me squelching underneath my feet. This thing wasn't Morten. Not anymore. He got up and started towards me in a disturbingly calm manner. I backed up more, holding him at distance with the barrel of my .38.
Morten, what are you doing?
You should join us, Nate. It's so nice and safe here.
I unlatched the safety and cocked the hammer back.
Stop!
You won't have to do anything again. Let us do everything for you.
Back the fuck up! I'm warning you!
Give up control, Nathan. Become a passenger.
My back was pushed against the hole.
Nowhere to run. Nowhere to hide. Humans can't live through the storm inside.
He lunged towards me, his face contorting. And without hesitation, I fired a round into his forehead.
He slumped over onto the ground, a gross, fleshy film peeling off of him. And lurched back towards the other parts.
Fuck!
Was all I could muster, frustratedly, staring down at his body. I grappled with what had just happened, not able to process it, as choked sobs left my mouth. My stepdad was dead, his real body long gone, and whatever had become him slumped over in front of me, looking just like him. I screamed loudly, before forcing myself back through the hole and back into the forest. I felt hot tears quickly freeze to my face, and my breaths had become stinging and harsh through my soft crying. To my shock, Nevada was standing by a tree outside the hole. She grabbed me and hugged me for a moment, trying to ask what happened as I mumbled incoherently. A few seconds later, she dug into me with her fingernails, and sternly urged me to quiet down while shushing and a shaky finger to her lip, her gaze turning upwards towards the cliff. I turned around slowly, snow hitting my glasses, obscuring the two creatures observing us with tilted heads and clicky groans. I finally had the chance to see what they were. The one on the left sat perched on a branch like a monkey. Its eyes shone like diamonds as they grazed me, bright light springing forth from them, and its mouth, a wide slit running down its face in a twisted, pulled way towards its cheek. The right one gripped sturdily onto a tree, peering around curiously, its body the same, but face different. It had no nose, but beaded black eyes that tore into me. Its jaw was splayed in a wide grin. Rows of humanoid teeth multiplied and seated in a sickening display, rotting like wood in a shallow, bloody pool. Both watched from the height of the fog, their presence feeling ephemeral and eternal, like they were biblical angels. I backed up, grabbing Nevada by the hand and slowly guiding us backwards. As the groans turned to shrieks, we separated, full on sprinting through the snow the best we could. I tripped once or twice as snow blocked my vision. The second time, I looked backwards. One supernatural assailant jumped through the trees and watched with an eager hunt on their faces. Nevada made her way towards me and grabbed my hand.
Nate, we gotta fucking go.
We kept moving, stepping up and over the high snows, the falling blusters covering up any evidence that we were there. Eventually, we made it back to our car, still on the roadside. Quickly, we dove back in, and I raced full speed towards town, the smell of gunpowder polluting the car's air.
What happened back there?
Nevada implored.
Martin, he's dead.
What? How? What happened?
Those fucking things, Nevada.
What do you mean?
Those things. They took Martin and the other people. They're becoming them.
What? Like clones?
I guess.
So, where was Martin?
I already cloned. I had to kill him. It wasn't Martin anymore.
Holy shit, Nate. What the fuck did we get ourselves into?
I don't know. I'm so fucking sorry you came with me.
She stared blankly off for a moment before grabbing my arm.
I'm not.
She just looked over at me, her eyes big, and I just sadly smirked at her when I glanced over. We drove the rest of the way in solemn silence. When we got back in, it was way past midnight. I sat up, staring at the wall and occasionally checking the windows, while Nevada sat on the shower floor for most of the night. We packed our bags and loaded the SUV through tired eyes in the morning. When I asked Nevada if she found anything in Martin's car, she didn't turn up any results. No information that was useful to us, at least. I told Mom we didn't find anything. I didn't have the heart to tell her the truth about Martin or anybody else. I said I had to head back to the city for work, but that I'd call her when we got in. I also made sure to give my dad a hug before I left, asking him to look after Mom and granting him the trust he wanted. We drove through town on our way out, and I had one idea before leaving. I stepped out the diner to use a payphone. I called the FBI anonymous tip line, telling them approximately where the nest was, implying it was urgent they checked it out. They wanted more info, but I simply hung up, trying my best to not think about it or attach myself any further. I couldn't get those creatures out of my head, the pilots, as I came to call them. I remembered Martin's clone urging me to become a passenger, which makes me wonder if Martin was still in there somewhere. I call them pilots, as they seem to take the host on a trip, one that you can't come back from. All you can do is sit back and watch the plane go down, taking others with it. I don't know where they came from, and I'm still not sure if there's more somewhere else. I've had little time to really think about it at the moment. Nevada and I were husks as we started away from Arrow Creek. She stared blankly out at the road ahead, too scared to look out the windows and into the forest, and I felt the same hesitation. But as we drove slowly, she kept her hand in mine, and her head laid against my shoulder. Despite everything we saw, maybe the one thing that was still okay was us. The silence was a lot less uncomfortable with her next to me. As we took the country roads out of town towards the highway, the wind whistled, and even miles out from town, I really couldn't shake the feeling that we were being watched.
Yo, it's Jay Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
That was The Whiteout by Joe Barbarullo, performed by our guest, Vidith22. Now that one gets under your skin, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The way the storm itself becomes this looming, inescapable force, and then slow realization that something else is lurking in the snow, that's the kind of horror that sticks with you.
Tell me about it. Whew. Is it chilly in here, or just me? Craig, turn up the heat, would you? Whew. Anyway, coming up next is a story that trades ice and snow for something even more ominous. A sky painted crimson, and the primal forces it awakens. But before we get to that, Vidith22 has an exciting announcement.
That's right, Jeff. On January 30th, 2025, I'll be premiering my narration of Ombrophobia, a brand new horror story by Chilling Tales for Dark Nights creator Craig Groshek, exclusively on my YouTube channel. Without giving too much away, let's just say that if you've ever felt uneasy about heavy rain, this story is going to give you a whole new reason to be afraid of a storm.
Sounds incredible. Listeners, mark your calendars for January 30th and head over to Vidith22's YouTube channel to catch his exclusive performance of Ombrophobia. You won't want to miss it. And now, let's get into our second story of the night.
Our next story tonight comes to us courtesy of Necessary Walrus 1703. There's something about a blood-red moon that feels like an omen. That warning is more than just superstition. It's a prelude to terror. Without further ado, as performed by yours truly, here's Blood Moon Rising. I remember the day I found it as if it were yesterday. The late afternoon sun hung low in the sky, casting long shadows across the flea market on the outskirts of our quaint little town. It was the kind of day where everything seemed still, the heat lingering, pressing down on everything. The dry, hot breeze stirred the dust, kicking up tiny whirlwinds as I walked through the narrow aisles with my dog, Charlie, scanning the rows of vendors with growing frustration. The farm wasn't doing well this season. Pests, birds, and rodents were tearing through the crops with an almost savage determination. Clara and I had tried everything. Scare tactics, traps, sprays, but nothing seemed to keep them away. It was as if the very land itself was rebelling against us. Sometimes I wonder if this was an act of sabotage by Mr. Monroe, who had been greedily eyeing my land for a while now. But no matter the cause, the outcome was the same. The crops were wilting, the soil dry, despite the endless hours I'd spent watering them, and every morning brought more damage, more destruction. The farm was struggling, and so were we. We weren't just facing financial ruin. This was ancestral land, passed down through seven generations. Losing it would mean losing a piece of ourselves. Clara's patience was wearing thin, though she never showed it. But I saw it in the way she pressed her lips together when the kids weren't looking, or the tightness in her shoulders when we sat down at the kitchen table to try and budget for the week. We couldn't afford another bad season. The stress was eating at both of us, turning our once lively dinner table conversations into tense silence. I was desperate, grasping at straws, literally trying to find something, anything that might help. I figured maybe this flea market would have something useful, though I didn't know what exactly I was looking for. That's when I saw it. Tucked between a pile of rusted tools, frayed ropes, and battered knickknacks was a scarecrow. It was old, worn out, and tattered, the kind of thing that had been through too many summers and winters, far more than it should have survived. Its burlap face was faded, sun-bleached, and split in places, the frayed edges fluttering in the wind like dead skin peeling from an old wound. Its clothes, a pair of ripped overalls and a threadbare flannel shirt,
hung limp from its crooked frame, remnants of an era long forgotten. Despite its ragged appearance, something about it drew me in, and I couldn't look away. Maybe it was the unnatural way it stood out among the clutter, or maybe it was the way the light seems to dim around it when I looked at it. I couldn't shake the feeling it was watching me, as if its dark, hollow eyes were tracking my every move, and the crooked smile stretched unnaturally wide, almost up to its ears, as though it knew a secret I didn't. The Scarecrow seemed to catch Charlie's fancy, too. He sniffed it cautiously before placing his paw on it, almost as if testing whether it was real. I snapped out of my thoughts when a man's voice suddenly cut through the eerie silence. It was the owner. He was a small, hunched figure standing behind the stall, half hidden in the shadows beneath a wide-brimmed hat. His leathery skin, deeply lined with wrinkles, hinted at a long, hard life. His face remained mostly obscured, his eyes concealed in the shadow of the hat, making it impossible to guess his age. An instinctual urge told me to turn away. Both the Scarecrow and the man unsettled me in ways I couldn't explain.
"You're looking for some to keep the birds away, aren't you?"
he said, without glancing up, his voice gravelly and dry. There was an accent, too, faint but old-fashioned, as though it belonged to another era. I blinked, startled by his accuracy. How could he know? I thought to myself. I nodded slowly, unsure of what to say, my mouth suddenly dry. Then he looked up, meeting my gaze for a fleeting moment.
"This here'll do the trick," he said, gesturing toward the Scarecrow with a bony finger. "No birds, no rodents, no pests. You'll see."
I hesitated, taking a closer look at the Scarecrow. It looked as if it would fall apart if I so much as touched it. The wind tugged at its loose stitches, making them sway slightly, and I noticed a faint odor. Musty, like damp earth mixed with decay.
"Does it work?"
I asked, my voice filled with skepticism. I didn't want to come off as too desperate, but I was. The man grinned, revealing a set of yellowed, uneven teeth.
"It works,"
he said, with an air of certainty that felt unsettling.
"Better than you think. Just set it up in your field. It'll do the rest."
My gut twisted with unease, and despite the creeping dread, I handed over the little cash I had left. The man took it without another word. I heaved the Scarecrow into the bed of my truck, its hollow, straw-filled body thudding against the metal as it started my drive back to the farm. When I got home, the sun was setting, casting an orange hue across the farm. I glanced toward the house, where the warm light of the kitchen spilled through the windows. Clara was inside, cooking dinner, while the kids helped her set the table. The smell of roasting chicken wafted into the air. Charlie and I were immediately greeted by Sir Sunrise, a rooster who quietly came and perched himself on the back of the truck as I parked near the front porch. He observed in silence as I unloaded the Scarecrow. Sir Sunrise earned his name from my 8-year-old son, Luke, thanks to his remarkable habit of crowing at exactly 6 a.m. every morning. It didn't matter if it was pouring rain, the middle of winter, or a cloudy morning where the sun didn't show. He always knew when it was time. He'd march up and down the porch, his triumphant cock-a-doodle-doo echoing for a full minute, ensuring the entire Smith household woke to his call. Oddly enough, that was the only time he ever crowed, even though he spent the rest of the day busily wandering the farm. Even stranger was the quiet, almost unspoken friendship he shared with Charlie. The two seemed to enjoy each other's company in a way that always surprised me. I hoisted the Scarecrow into my shoulders and made my way toward the field. The crops swayed in the soft evening breeze, rows of corn and wheat stretching out before me like sentinels. I chose a spot right in the middle, far enough from the house, but close enough that I could still watch it from the upstairs window. I attached the Scarecrow to a wooden pole that was already planted deep in the soil. It stood, crooked and eerie, its burlap face staring blankly at the sky. Sir Sunrise inaugurated the new addition in the field by performing a couple of customary laps around the pole before taking off, with Charlie eagerly chasing after him. My eyes, however, drifted toward Mr. Monroe's factory in the distance. For years, he'd been acquiring land for my neighbors, and was determined to buy my property as well. He wasn't pleased when I turned him down. Ever since then, my farm has suffered. My crops have been constantly under attack, making me wonder if he was in any way involved. But without proof, all I could do was continue my work and hope things would eventually turn around. I took one last look at the scarecrow before walking back home to join my wife and kids for dinner. That night, sleep didn't come easily. I tossed and turned, my mind replaying the image of the scarecrow in the field, motionless, seemingly unthreatening, yet somehow menacing. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw that stitched smile, wide and knowing, as though it was waiting for something. Was I expecting some sort of miracle from it? Is that why I felt this knot in my stomach? Because deep down, I knew I was acting out of desperation and not thinking rationally. The wind howled outside, rattling the shutters, but beyond that, there was silence. No crows cawing, no rustling in the crops, just an unsettling, unnatural silence. Meanwhile, Clara slept soundly beside me. I noticed the cut above her eyebrow, even in the pale moonlight, a scar from her youth. Despite her challenging childhood, she had a gift for finding peace in chaos, while I remained a light sleeper, needing exhaustion to fall into a deep slumber. I rolled over, pulling the blanket tighter around me and eventually drifting to sleep. When morning finally came, I stepped outside, half expecting to find the fields torn apart like before. But they were untouched. Not a single stalk was damaged. I looked toward the scarecrow, still standing in the same spot, and felt a wave of relief wash over me. Maybe the old peddler was right. Maybe it really was that effective. A couple more days went by, and the crops remained unharmed. Not a single bird or rodent dared to come near them. For the first time in months, I felt a glimmer of hope, a lightness in my chest that I hadn't felt in ages. I didn't fully understand how a scarecrow could make such a difference, that the results defied logic, but I wasn't about to question it now. Clara noticed the shift in my mood, too, and began to believe again herself. She watched our children, Emma and Luke, play among the crops, their laughter ringing through the air like music after a long silence. It was as if the scarecrow had brought back more than just safety for the crops. It had brought back hope. But on the fourth night, things began to take a strange turn. I woke up in the dead of night to the sound of Sir Sunrise, crowing, loud, persistent, and completely out of character. He was never one to crow at night. His routine was always the same, like clockwork at 6 a.m. My body, heavy with sleep, resisted the urge to get up. I waited, hoping he'd stop. But Sir Sunrise kept going, his calls growing louder, more driven. With a groan, I dragged myself out of bed and stumbled toward the window, expecting to see him perched where he usually roosted. But instead, Sir Sunrise was on the front porch, pacing back and forth, his head bobbing furiously, crowing as if the morning sun was already shining. But the thing that made my stomach lurch wasn't him. It was the moon. It hung in the sky, casting a pale glow over the fields. The crops swayed gently in the breeze, bathed in a strange, coppery light. It was only then that I realized it wasn't just any moon. It was a total lunar eclipse. The blood moon hung above, eerie and red, painting the field in a haunting glow. But what I saw next stopped me cold. The scarecrow. It wasn't where I had left it. For a moment, I just stood there, blinking, my tired mind scrambling to make sense of what I was seeing. I rubbed my eyes, squinted, even stepped closer to the window. But no matter how much I tried to rationalize it, there it was, standing at the far end of the field, a place I had never placed it. My heart pounded in my chest. Who could have moved it, and why? Was it some prank? But who would come all the way out here in the middle of the night just for that? My thoughts raced, reaching for logical explanations that didn't quite add up. Maybe it was just my groggy, sleep-deprived brain playing tricks on me. The moonlight, the shadows, it could have easily created an illusion. Or maybe it was the wind, somehow shifting the scarecrow's position. Scarecrows were lights, after all. It could have been anything, right? I shook my head, telling myself it didn't matter. I could fix it in the morning. Still unsettled, I forced myself back to bed. But sleep didn't come easily. My dreams were strange, fragmented, filled with shadowy figures moving through the fields. As the first light of dawn crept over the horizon, I got out of bed, hoping to shake off the strange feeling from the night before. To my relief, when I looked out the window, the scarecrow was back in its original spot. I sighed, feeling a wave of calm wash over me, but only for a fleeting moment. Because when my gaze swept across the field, something caught my eye, and it made my stomach drop. A flock of crows were circling low over a patch of land near the edge of the field, the very spot where I had seen the scarecrow standing the night before. I felt a chill crawl down my spine. This was never going to be good news. Without hesitation, I bolted out of the house and raced toward the spot where the birds hovered, their dark wings cutting through the sky like a bad omen. The birds flew away when I reached the area, but what I saw made me momentarily speechless. Scattered among the crops were dead animals, birds, rodents, frogs, and other small creatures. They weren't just randomly lying there either. Their bodies were arranged in peculiar, almost ritualistic patterns. Circles, spirals, rows, shapes that made my skin crawl. And the worst part, straw. Pieces of straw, like the kind stuffed inside the scarecrow, were strewn around the animals, as if linking them to the figure that now loomed in the field. I knelt down, my fingers brushing over the straw. At first, I wanted to believe it was a predator, some animal playing tricks, a fox or wild dog arranging its kills. But that thought quickly crumbled. The arrangement of the bodies was too precise, too deliberate. It felt wrong. Could this be Mr. Monroe's doing? Another twisted attempt by him to sabotage my farm. Before I could even finish the thought, Clara's voice echoed across the field, her tone sounding nervous and urgent. I looked up and saw her in the distance, standing on the front porch, her posture tense, as though trying to intervene before something happened. But the thick rows of crops blocked my view, making it impossible to see what had her so panicked. I set off again, this time heading back toward the entrance of my own house. As I got closer, the menacing growl of Charlie pierced the air. When I pushed through the last of the crops, I saw him engaged in a tense standoff, his fur matted and streaked with blood, growling fiercely at Sir Sunrise. The rooster was badly injured, his feathers in disarray and blood dripping onto the ground. He wobbled, struggling to stay upright. He remained defiant, determined to hold his ground in the fight. But Charlie wasn't finished. Before I could intervene, he lunged at the rooster, clamping down on his throat with his teeth. With a violent shake of his head, I heard the sickening snap of bone. Charlie finally released him, and the lifeless body dropped to the ground. Horror washed over me as blood pooled around the carcass. Charlie cleared his throat a couple of times, and in slow motion, I saw him extend his tongue, licking the blood clean off the floor in one swift motion. I stood, frozen, unable to look away, as Charlie, his tongue stained with blood and dirt, jerked and crouched momentarily, eyes closed, tilting his head down, before releasing a howl with his muzzle pointed skyward. He then darted off into the field before I could pin him down. I chased after him, but it was clear he wasn't interested in being found. I expected he would eventually find his way back home, though I wasn't sure what I would do with him upon his return. I had never seen him behave this way before. I struggled to piece together the events of the morning, wondering if there could be any correlation to last night. Deep down, I couldn't ignore the gnawing suspicion forming in my gut. This all began the moment I brought that scarecrow home. What had been a curious purchase at a roadside stand had now morphed into a source of growing dread, its tendrils curling tighter around my mind. And what about the dead animals? Were they also Charlie's doing? I had no clear answer, and I reluctantly glanced at the scarecrow, perfectly positioned in the middle of the field. The smile stretching across its face stirred an uneasy feeling in me. "That's strike one, Patrick," a voice echoed in my head at that very moment. And for the first time, I considered getting rid of it. But as I looked at the crops around me, I was quietly taken aback by the risks I was willing to accept. Finally, gathering my composure, I dealt with the dead animals, burying them one by one in haste, before Clara could notice. She was already upset about Sir Sunrise and had spent the day looking for Charlie, convinced they had a falling out. Her suspicions were not yet on the scarecrow, and I hoped to keep it that way. Still, I forced myself to focus on the positives. The crops were thriving, better than ever, in fact. The rows were thick with green, healthy stalks, and the vegetables were coming in larger than expected. My family was on track to recoup our losses, and hopefully that would put us in a better financial position than we had been in years. By that night, as the wind whistled through the trees and rustled the leaves, I couldn't shake the feeling that something was wrong. Something was out there, watching us. Scarecrow was more than just straw and cloth, and I could feel that deep in my bones. I pressed the pillow to my ears, desperate to drown out the sounds of the night and drift off to sleep. But then, a loud, piercing howl shattered the stillness. It was Charlie, no doubt, somewhere out in the field in the distance, howling into the night. Somehow, I eventually succumbed to exhaustion and drifted off to sleep. But I was jolted awake by my daughter Emma's urgent voice calling for me.
"Dad, come quick!"
Her frantic tone sliced through the morning calm like a knife, pulling me from my dreams. Heart racing, I scrambled out of bed and rushed outside. The sun was just beginning to rise, casting a pale light across the farm. I spotted Emma near the edge of the field, crouched next to Charlie. A wave of dread washed over me as I approached. There lay Charlie, lifeless and caked in mud, his front paws badly bruised, and the flesh peeled back, exposing the jutting bones. It was clear he had been digging with a frantic desperation and eventually died from the sheer exhaustion. Next to him was a mound of sand, the grave where Sir Sunrise had been buried.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Emma looked up at me, tears streaming down her face.
"I don't know what happened, Dad. I found him like this."
The horror of the scene settled over me, a chilling weight in my chest. Clara soon joined us, and we decided to bury Charlie with Sir Sunrise, since they were pals after all. Once everybody went back inside, I ventured into the field, holding a shovel in my hand, wondering what else I might uncover. As I walked through the field, I noticed small mounds of earth scattered around, like hastily made burial sites. It was all too clear now what Charlie had been doing throughout the night. With a shovel, I dug into one of the mounds and uncovered a dead pigeon. Another revealed a large rodent. The field was littered with these makeshift graves,
and I couldn't even guess how many there were. When I turned, my stomach clenched. Luke was standing there, his face pale, eyes wide with fear.
"What's going on, Dad?"
he asked, his voice trembling with confusion as he looked around. I forced a smile, kneeling down and placing my hands gently on his shoulders. "Nothing to worry about, buddy," I said, keeping my tone calm. "Charlie was just being Charlie. We'll take care of him." For the next 15 minutes, I tried to reassure him, telling him he had to be strong, that growing up meant taking responsibility and knowing when to keep things to himself. "You're a man now," I said, "and sometimes we do what we have to protect the family. Don't mention this to Clara or Emma, okay? They're already worried enough." Luke nodded, but the unease in his eyes was hard to miss. I hated myself for what I was doing, gaslighting my own son. But with the harvest only a couple of weeks away, I had no choice. The farm had to come first. As Luke slowly made his way back to the house, I glanced toward Mr. Monroe's property in the distance, and then back at the scarecrow. I felt a lump form in my throat. "That's strike two, Patrick," I muttered to myself. I knew I couldn't handle another incident like this. If anything else happened, I'd have to start thinking seriously about other contingencies. Time was running out. Determined to put my fears to rest, I decided to keep watching over the field myself, alone, in the dead of night. So, the rest of the morning, I tended to the field, watering the crops and going about my usual farming routine. And when evening finally arrived, we all ate our meal in silence. One by one, everyone retreated to their rooms while I remained vigilant. Once everyone was in bed, I grabbed my shotgun and crept up to the second floor, where I had a clear view of the entire field. I had already set up lights at the corners so that I had some visibility, even on a new moon night. I positioned myself at the window, determined to stay awake through the night. Hours ticked by slowly. The only sounds were the faint whisper of the wind and the occasional creak of the old farmhouse settling around me. My eyes eventually grew heavy, even as my body fought the exhaustion at every level. But I must have drifted off at some point, because when I opened my eyes again, I was startled by how still everything seemed. I instinctively glanced out the window, expecting to see the familiar silhouette of the scarecrow standing in its usual spot. But it wasn't there. My heart leapt in my throat as I scanned the field. And then I saw it. Moving. The scarecrow was moving. Not walking, not stumbling, but drifting. It glided across the ground as if something unseen was pulling it, dragging it toward the far end of the field. Then it suddenly stopped, and to my horror, I saw the birds descend quietly around it. My hands trembled as I bolted out of the chair, shotgun in one hand and the old lantern in the other. I didn't wake Clara or the kids. I didn't want to frighten them, but my pulse pounded in my ears as I sprinted into the field, the lantern swinging wildly in my arm. The scarecrow, now a distant silhouette, was still drifting, disappearing into the dark edges of the field. I sprinted after it, the lantern's glow swinging wildly in the darkness. When I reached the spot, I nearly dropped it. Dead animals lay scattered everywhere. Birds, mice, frogs, and even a rabbit, arranged in eerie, precise circles. The smell of decay clinging to the air. Out of the corner of my eye, I then spotted it again. The scarecrow, this time drifting slowly toward the opposite end. I ran toward it again, gripping my shotgun tightly as the lantern swayed in my hand and the wind howled around me. But as I approached the scarecrow, I froze. It wasn't the scarecrow that terrified me. It was Emma, my 12-year-old daughter, carrying the scarecrow as if it weighed nothing.
The pole rested effortlessly on her small shoulder, her hands gripping it firmly, yet without emotion. Her movements were slow and mechanical, her eyes wide and blank, as if she were trapped in a trance. Behind her, Luke knelt in the dirt, his small hands stained with blood. He was carefully arranging a sparrow's body among the others, his face blank, his eyes unblinking. With a firm grip, he squeezed another rat's neck until it went limp, then placed it on the ground, completing a circle of dead animals. I immediately scanned the field, looking for Clara, but she was nowhere in sight. And I realized she must still be in bed. That was when I understood. The Scarecrow. He was coming for Clara by going after our kids. A wave of dread rose in my chest as I choked out a call, my voice thick with fear.
Eva! Luke! What are you doing?
They didn't respond. They didn't even flinch. Emma kept walking, gripping the pole attached to the Scarecrow and moving forward. Luke silently followed behind her. Then, Emma suddenly stopped. She raised the Scarecrow and pointed it westward. And from the shadows, animals suddenly emerged. Birds swooped down from the trees, rodents scurried out of the soil, and insects crawled from every crevice, all of them moving toward the Scarecrow with eerie obedience. I could only watch in horror as Luke picked up a rock and began smashing the animals one by one. Each brutal strike was met with a sickening thud, and yet none of the creatures moved. They remained rooted to their spots, oblivious to the carnage unfolding around them. The air felt thick with something sinister, something beyond my understanding. My chest tightened as I staggered back, gasping for air. This wasn't real. It couldn't be real. Then, Luke bent down, grabbed a dead rodent from the ground, and sank his teeth into it. He bit into the fur with the desperation of a ravenous animal, blood smearing his lips as he chewed, completely lost in the frenzy. A wave of nausea washed over me as I realized how the Scarecrow was controlling my children, transforming them into something unnatural, something monstrous. A torrent of anger erupted inside me, every cell in my body pulsing with raw fury. My hands shook when my mind was suddenly clear. I knew exactly what I had to do. I dropped my lantern and rushed toward Emma, yanking the Scarecrow from her hands and then hurling it to the ground. My kids remained mute spectators, rooted to their spots as they continued to be trapped in their hypnotic trance. I grabbed the lantern and smashed it against the Scarecrow with all my might. It shattered on impact, igniting the Scarecrow in flames. Without hesitation, I fired my shotgun at the fuel-soaked straw. And an explosion erupted, engulfing the figure in a fiery blaze. Emma blinked for the first time, as if suddenly waking from a dream, confused about how she ended up in the middle of the field. My son, Luke, stared down at his blood-stained hands, clutching the dead rat. Horror washed over his face, his lip trembling as he met my eyes.
I didn't mean to, Daddy. I didn't mean to.
He sobbed, wiping the blood from his mouth with the back of his hand. I dropped to my knees, pulling both of them into my arms as the fire crackled and roared, the acrid smell of burning straw filling the air. Through the flames, I watched a shadowy figure emerge, its silhouette shaped like a man, writhing and twisting, struggling to break free. For a fleeting moment, it seemed almost alive, thrashing in a desperate attempt to escape the flames. But the fires consumed him, pulling him deeper into the inferno until, at last, he vanished.
I closed my eyes briefly, using the moment to utter a silent prayer to the Lord, hugging my children tighter, grateful that it was finally behind us. Together, we slowly walked back to the house, each step laden with the weight of what had just transpired. Just as we were about to enter the house, Clara opened the door, worry etched across her face. She had woken up sensing something was wrong, and when she found us missing, fear gripped her. As we stepped inside, she wrapped us in a warm embrace. I immediately felt a sense of relief, hoping that this whole nightmare was finally behind us. Over the next few weeks, my crops flourished, yielding a harvest that far exceeded my expectations. We were pulled back from the brink of financial ruin, but it came at a cost. Both Emma and Luke suffered from relentless nightmares, waking up screaming in the night, and it would be months before they could fully recover. I, too, struggled with sleep, waking in the dead of night, drenched in sweat, haunted by the memory of the scarecrow. It's gone, I keep telling myself. The scarecrow is gone. And every night, I pray that it would stay that way.
That was Blood Moon Rising by Necessary Walrus, 1703. I think I went to school with that guy. Performed again by our guest, Vidith 22. What a slow burn nightmare, huh?
Absolutely. The way this story builds tension, that feeling that something is just off, before finally erupting into full-blown horror. That's my kind of storytelling.
Necessary Walrus 7. Oh, that guy killed me in Fortnite. I know that guy. Aimbot. Anyway, listeners, if you enjoyed tonight's episode, be sure to check out Vidith 22 across all his platforms. That's V-I-I-D-I-T-H 22 on YouTube, Instagram, X, and Patreon. And don't forget to check out his upcoming narration of Ombrophobia by Craig Groshek, premiering January 30th, exclusively on his channel. When you visit him, please do us a favor and let him know you heard about him here on Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and that we sent you. It would mean a lot to us.
Thanks, Jeff. It means the world to me, too. We're all in this together.
We sure are, and every little bit helps. Speaking of which, if you're listening to Chilling Tales on YouTube and would like to support our show, don't forget to hit the thumbs up button, leave a comment, and subscribe. Tap that bell icon so you're notified the moment we release new content. And trust me, you won't want to miss what's coming next. If tonight's stories left you craving even more chills, you can also visit chillingtalesfordarknights.com and become a patron, starting at just $7.99 a month. Or even less if you choose an annual plan. You'll gain exclusive access to our entire library of content, including ad-free episodes, bonus material, and early access to all our new releases. It's the best way to support the program and keep the nightmares alive. We'd also love to hear from you. Follow us on social media to stay connected. Whether it's Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, you'll find sneak peeks, updates, and community discussions about the stories you love. And don't be shy about tagging us or sharing your thoughts. We appreciate your feedback. I'm Jeff Sturdivant, and it's been my pleasure to guide you through tonight's terrifying tales. Don't forget, we'll be welcoming a new guest narrator each Wednesday, so stay tuned for next week's surprise guest, where they, and we, will once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Sweet dreams, listeners. Sweet dreams.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games that's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.